Retina Rounds, podcast number 16. Continuing our conversation with Dr. Omar Shakir, we're going to dive further into the ins and outs of office-based surgery. Now, my concerns, and I think the concerns of most vitreoretinal surgeons, center around patient safety. We discuss this issue more, as well as delving into topics like patient access, financial considerations, and potential ethical issues around office-based surgery. If you haven't already, make sure to check out part one of our conversation in podcast 15. Well, welcome back to Retina Rounds, everyone. We're pleased to welcome back Dr. Omar Shakir, who is the founder of Coastal Eye Surgeons in Greenwich, Connecticut, to tell us more about the ins and outs of office-based surgery. Dr. Shakir, thanks again for joining us.
Of course. No, thank you for having me again.
Well, you know, I wanted to continue our conversation about safety with office-based surgery. Now, you've described your approach. You are able to manage patients' anxiety with Valium, oral Valium, pain with Septinon's block. But for providers who may not be as comfortable managing the anxiety while performing the surgery, is including an anesthesiologist in the room an option? I know that there are other people who are doing posterior segment office-based surgery. What other models are you aware of that may be a little bit different than what your approach is?
Yeah, you could certainly replicate your experience in an ambulatory surgery center or a hospital setting in terms of anesthesiologists. So oftentimes large anesthesia groups in town are looking to add on more sites. For them, their contracts with their insurers are usually agnostic to site of service. So the meaning that they could easily re-credential into your space if you built an OBS and wanted to have anesthesia presence there. That's for each individual provider to decide, and then how those contracts are structured. You know, usually the anesthesia group will want some guaranteed hourly, and then they may also want to bill. That's how powerful anesthesia is becoming these days. But be forewarned that anesthesia services, you know, internationally, not just the United States, but they're tough to find. I mean, they are really a scarce resource, and that's why they have so many anesthesia extending providers. And if you use an extending provider, then it's going to function under your license, which, you know, you may or may not be comfortable with managing. I love doing oral sedation because it's safe. You know, it's safe cardiovascular risk-wise, pulmonary-wise, and I feel comfortable with it. It manages their anxiety. But certainly, if you wanted to bring an anesthesiologist in, you can do it. It does add another layer on top of all of this. I love the pioneering aspect and, you know, the forward progress in making this approach a more exportable approach, a more reproducible approach, a less resource-intensive approach by doing this without anesthesia services. But you could certainly do it.
And how does liability insurance work? I know that OMIC actually does insure for office-based surgery, but what has it been your experience?
Yeah, I have OMIC insurance on a separate rider that attaches to my professional liability insurance. So that's the best way, in my opinion, to do it. I know there are many providers in different states where they go with different malpractice carriers. That I wouldn't be as familiar with, and I wouldn't be able to comment on. But I will say that for OMIC, if you are accredited, so for instance, we are accredited by the Joint Commission, then you are eligible for malpractice coverage. And the entity itself is covered. You doing, any sedation is a covered procedure. You doing surgical management of diseases is covered. And it's an extension of your existing disability policy, and you can up the amounts to cover to an even greater amount. But OMIC is amazing at what they advise based on their past data and past history as what those limits should look like. That part about the getting the accreditation first, that's the most difficult piece of all of this, because it's sort of chicken or egg, right? You can't get accredited unless you have some sort of coverage, usually, and you can't get coverage unless you have accreditation. So how does that work? Not a plug for IOR, because like I said, I have financial interest at stake here, but that's one of the perks of using a consultant like IOR, is that you get automatic coverage because that's been vetted by OMIC. And so that's very helpful. You could certainly do it on your own. You have to have a certain amount of cases usually to show before you can go for accreditation. So then you may be operating without coverage, without malpractice coverage in that situation, which a lot of people do. And then eventually the accreditation comes and then they get their coverage, their malpractice coverage. So in short, it's different by what carriers, but you do ultimately need to seek accreditation so that you can get malpractice coverage.
And for those people who are unfamiliar with the accreditation process, what are the types of things that Joint Commission is looking for before they issue an accreditation to your facility?
There's a ton, and a lot of that has to do with how you keep your standard operating protocols. You need us SOPs for everything. If you've ever done clinical trials work, it's the same type of deal. You need an SOP to cover everything, literally everything you can imagine, even a fire drill or what's going to happen if electricity goes out. How do you keep your log books for medication waste? Same thing for sterilization protocols, all this stuff. So that's mainly what an accreditation looks like. The actual surgical experience, like you doing the surgery, they'll watch a case or two, but that's not their primary interest because you're already fully licensed as a medical provider and surgical provider. So they're not going to step on any toes there. It's really about everything else. And just like I mentioned before, running an operating suite in your office, you want a consultant. You definitely want a consultant if you're going to do accreditation through the Joint Commission, because there's a lot that goes into it, and there's just no possible way you could be prepared for a situation like that. So I felt overly prepared, because I already done this 100 times, so this was just another another hurdle for them. But the only additional piece was the retina piece, which wasn't really any different for accreditation purposes. So yeah, that's what I would say is you have to get very familiar with all of the little processes that go into running, just as if you were to run an ASC, into running the actual operations of it, how the sterile protocols work. I mean, it's down to the smallest little science of like, how are you wrapping your trays? And what material are you using, and how are you recording that? There's a lot.
And do your consultants help you train your staff as well so that they understand? I mean, it's one thing to have SOPs in place, but also we need staff that really understand it and are trained to execute that.
Yeah, we were lucky that again, going through IOR partners, that they're on site during this. So that's the biggest piece of this is managing the on-site visit. Right, because there's a lot of stuff you prepare beforehand and afterwards, but really the on-site visit is how you get the accreditation. So they were there, and staff does go through walkthroughs, and there's kind of game day scenarios, and you try to prepare as much as you can. So we did do that, full walkthroughs of all the different pieces that they'll be looking at. But on the day of, your consultant should really be present because it can be a lot. And honestly, if you're doing your operation, your staff is helping you do the operation, you just don't have the time to also then usher the inspector with the accreditor with Joint Commission, because things will come to a grinding halt. I mean, they really want to stop and look at all of it, the log books, the recording logs, all of that SOPs need to be printed and shown. And then you have to do a debrief for a long time afterwards. We went through both the initial accreditation process and through recredentialing just recently. And I will tell you that there's a lot that goes into it, and you really want help on site. And the people who have been through this before, right? Nursing administrators are really good at this stuff. That's what I would highly recommend.
And the consultant obviously important as you're building out the OR, building out the SOPs, getting through the accreditation process. But what ongoing relationship or what ongoing support do they provide, if any?
A consultant in general?
Yes.
Yeah, again, I keep going back to the the analogy of running an ASC. So there's a lot of other stuff behind the scenes that maybe not all surgeons would be privy to, but you need to have some type of governance, right? And that's what makes these entities special. Just like a hospital would have its board and it has tons of other boards for everything you can imagine. An ASC is a mini version of that. And an OBS is another mini version of that. So you need to have some type of governing body structure. And it's not enough to just say the surgeon runs all that, because you need to have a peer review process in place and you need to have quality programs that are ongoing, and on a quarterly basis, you're meeting about that. And you need to have governance that has input from other people, not just from yourself, because you can't just stack a board with your own opinions. And the consultant, in my case, IOR, they also serve as seats on that governance committee so that we can have outside observership. I think that is really important in doing this properly. Is this isn't a one-man show or one-woman show. Is you really want to have the proper infrastructure in place. So that is a big piece of it, is the compliance piece with the governing body. And all of that needs to be written and also shown to, when you go through accreditation, that this is going to be a requirement to go through accreditation.
Got it. I want to shift gears a little bit. Earlier this week, we showed a case of a construction worker who had a metallic intraocular foreign body. First I was actually surprised that a relatively complex case like that could be performed in an office-based surgery setting. And so it was interesting to see that actually being performed. But aside from that, I think the backstory of being able to provide access to this individual who didn't have insurance and was basically a service that you provided free of charge as part of your sort of charitable outreach, I thought was a really interesting and really a really nice application of this. You know, I've been in situations plenty of times where I'm more than happy to forego my professional fees to be able to offer surgical services, but it's not just me. It's, you know, it's everybody else, the facility and all of that, and getting all of that organized to make it cost effective for patients is a challenge. And so when you have, you know, control over that, that certainly is, it sort of streamlines the process. So I just was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the charitable program you have and how that factors into office-based surgery.
Yeah. I was just looking over that case that I sent you, because we've done so many charitable cases, honestly. And that is one of the I love it. I could tell stories all day about this. I just want to hit on two quick stories, because it just sets the stage for how vitally important the success of office-based retina surgery is for the world, not just for the United States or for my little small world here, for everyone. This specific case, construction worker, undocumented, illegal, ends up in an academic center's hospital by a referral from a community hospital. And in a traditional pathway, this patient would go in for emergent surgery and then get billed, honestly, probably 100,000 plus, you know, in billable items for racking up the emergency room bills, OR, anesthesia facility, probably staying overnight, pain control, all this stuff. I mean, it's going to be a lot of money. And you know, the system sort of shrugs its shoulders at this. It says, well, we have to do emergency care and we have to take care of these people. And we do. But what we don't have to do is set them back for generations to come financially because they owe this. And, you know, again, the system shrugs its shoulders at that problem and says, well, you know, they may not have to pay it because the hospital may not chase it. Well, I mean, I don't know if they are understanding of the fact that this man's credit, if he's able to establish some type of, you know, bank credit, is ruined forever because he won't be able to pay this back. And these things get reported. You know, under a certain amount now, you don't get reported to the credit bureaus for this, but over amounts, and this would be well over that amount, yes, it does get reported. So we need to have a system in place to take care of people that need care. And it doesn't just need to be trauma, right? I mean, what if, like, I had a gentleman today, retinal detachment developed overnight, no insurance. What do we do with those people? I mean, Honestly, what do we do? Because you're lucky to be in an academic setting where maybe these patients can get taken care of more efficiently. But in a private practice setting, the only answer is referral. And refer to where? And who's going to be able to do that, right? I have oftentimes been in a position, even as a fellow, if you probably remember those days too, quarterbacking the social management piece of this. Like, how do I get this patient taken care of? Who's going to show up to take care of it? Which surgeon am I going to find who's going to be willing to give basically give their time for free and then not collect on this? So office-based surgery is the answer. I mean, it's so low resource utilization, and can be profitable in many other ways to subsidize that patient care. And because we're closing the financial system down to the smallest piece of it, which is just the surgeon, really. And the surgeon's larger practice there, we don't have to worry about financing, the hospital's private equity partners or all these other pieces of the financial puzzle that happen in these complex settings. We whittle it down to just a surgeon and their patient. Oftentimes, surgeons will literally give the shirt off their back or their own money from their own pocket to hope for a better outcome for their patients. And this has become a key part of our practice. And now the word has gotten out so far that we've become the referral source for a lot of, optometrists, ophthalmologists, even honestly for academic centers around us to send the patient our way because they know the patient will get taken care of in a very financially advantageous way. Now, we don't automatically just give everyone free care. We always, always, always attempt to collect because patients should pay, but as much as feasible. We're not in the business of determining financial ability, but we'll certainly try to collect because every physician should value their services and value their time and their expertise enough to ask for payment. And don't be shy about it. I mean, this is the world we live in. We live in a currency-driven world, unfortunately. So we do try, and if there's no attempt, if there's no ability to collect on it, I'm still going to provide the service, that's just a piece of how I want to practice and how I pitch OBS to be. But going back to the original stories, there was another gentleman who he I'm thinking a couple of different ones, but he had been bounced around from practice to practice and had a tube placed that was causing all kinds of issues. The tube had eroded. The tube was causing anterior segment issues, and pigment was being dispersed. Concurrently developed an RD. I mean, this was a complex case. Like I needed to do some anterior complex, anterior segment repair, and then of course deal with the retinal detachment. Just been bounced from place to place to place, and eventually a fellow calls me and was like, I don't know what to do because I don't even know if there's an attending who can quarterback most of this, and then I need probably two attendings, or if not a third attending, to do the different pieces of it. And then how are we going to coordinate all of them to get this patient taken care of who has no insurance? I was able to bring him, and I trust my skill set, and I pride myself on doing both anterior and posterior segment surgery. So I was able to take care of the patient and do all that, and do it for minimal cost to the system, whatever the patient basically ability to pay. And that's how you get people taken care of, right? And that's what's so important about this. Imagine the implications for international care, for places that just don't have the resources and the facilities to do this. You could literally set up an OR the same way that you set up a battlefield OR and be able to just do a whole bunch of cases without bringing massive teams with you, and do them efficiently. But my point being that these are complex cases. These are not easy surgeries, and we were able to perform them very comfortably with all of the instrumentation that I could ever want or need. Yes, removing metal from someone's eye is complicated, but so is most of retina surgery. So I don't buy that argument. Like, oh my God, you took someone with a metallic foreign body in their retina into your OBS? Hell yes. Like, where else are you proposing this be, and why not? I mean, my instrumentation is probably better than a lot of the hospital's instrumentation that they can't even find half the time because it's stuck in some central supply. When you ask for and 10 people are looking for it, they have no idea. Mine's right next to me. My staff knows exactly what I need and right where it is. And also there's no delay in care. I don't have to go through this complex, what is it? Pre-admission testing. I don't even know. I'm not even familiar nowadays with all that stuff, terminology, but yeah, there's no PAT. There's not, none of that stuff. We just take care of people.
Got it. Got it. I do want to make one plug for our safety net hospital system. I mean, there are safety net hospitals in the United States. LA County has a very robust one, LA County Department of Health Services. And I want to say this only because I was the chief of ophthalmology at one of our hospitals there, Harbor UCLA, for almost a decade or a little over a decade. And we would be able to take care of anybody who walked through the door. If they were LA County residents, they didn't get billed. So there are depending on where you are practicing, there are resources available to members of the community who just don't have insurance, don't have the means to be able to pay. But that's it's certainly not that way everywhere. And there are neighboring counties that don't have that type of infrastructure in place. So I like the idea
Totally.
of being able to, think outside the box and maybe expand our surgical offerings in places like office-based surgery to be able to address that need and to curtail costs for the benefit of the
I
patient.
think most places have infrastructures like that set up, but they're not easy to navigate. We had the similar thing where I trained at Yale as well. It's not easy to navigate. I mean, we could be talking minimum months delay, but usually years delay to get a patient actually scheduled because there's so much that goes into the planning, right? If it's a non-emergent case. And oftentimes these things are called non-emergent, even though, we may push it towards emergency just to get the patient taken care of, but you have to coordinate facility time, anesthesia time, surgeon time, and then get the social workers to go through all the paperwork process to make sure that that patient doesn't get charged. It's a lot of infrastructure and all that resource utilization costs time and money and effort as well, when this is just a way simpler way to do it. And we've found, honestly, that patients who come through this pathway of going through OBS, actually, they're willing to pay oftentimes. They're not, you, they can't afford thousands and thousands of dollars, but they can afford a little bit, and it actually helps them feel like they are part of it, right? They're actually earning the care that they want to be able to earn. It's just they can't afford the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in a hospital setting. That's a little too unreasonable. And then I'll also add one other piece to this, which is, my involvement in doing community care type stuff and charitable care got me the opportunity to work with American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons. And they're always looking for people to do cataract surgery and other needs. And I got the good fortune of being hooked up with Operation Sight, run by ASCRS. And wouldn't you know it, one of the patients that shows up through Operation Sight for surgery ends up needing a concurrent vitrectomy. What better place than to be at our center? And so was able to, it was a very tough case, but we got vision back, removing a 4+ NS with the bag was already ruptured, with a phaco frag, fixing a partial retinal detachment. I mean, it was a lot, and patients so grateful. And for that, we were able to get the honor of the ASCRS 2025 Volunteer of the Year.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, let's shift gears again to talk about how office-based surgery gets paid for, right? I think a lot of people may have questions about the finances because payers don't actually reimburse, or correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that payers don't reimburse for facility fees associated with office-based surgery. So how do you manage the overheads? There are obviously some overheads with PACS, and you've got your staff that you've got to pay for and all of that. So how do you manage the expense side of things when the payers may not necessarily reimburse for it?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a very difficult one. And I'm not the person with all the answers, but I know a little bit about our own personal experience. And this conversation will just have to continue on for years to come, because even Medicare doesn't really know. They do know that they want to pay for this. And they do know that this is a partial solution to their bigger problem, which is really expensive perioperative care. I mean, it is very, very expensive. And this is a perfect solution. They need to figure their own stuff out. Now, payers, they're going to pay for your professional codes. And it's, I won't say universally site agnostic, but almost universally, where if you're, let's say, a 67113, a complex retinal detachment repair, PVR membrane peeling, which we commonly do, you know, the service is performed in an ASC or a hospital, or in my case, in an office, the code pays, and it pays the same. It's not going to pay any different from where you're performing the service. Sometimes there may be a glitch in the payer system that they don't. It's just a weird thing to see a 67113 come in through an office, and it's as easy as getting on the phone. And that's part of the consultant approach as well. Having a consultant on board is they can do that work for you. So they'll get on the phone with the payer and say, hey, I know it looks weird for your system to process a claim of a complex retinal detachment repair coming through an office, but that is true. That's what happened here. And Dr. Shakir and his practice needs to get paid for it. Now, when it comes to facility fees, that's tough because you're not an independently licensed facility. So you cannot generate a facility claim form. Facility claim forms only originate through independently licensed facilities, right? They have a separate claim form that doesn't look at all like a professional claim form. And they get paid, depending on where they are, like a hospital setting, they get paid differently. And you get paid in an ASC setting. That being said, we haven't done this, but there are other clients within IOR and then outside clients or outside surgeons as well that have approached payers in their area, invited them into, and I think this is a really great strategy, and we're working on this as well, to invite payers and executives within those payer companies to come and see the office-based surgical approach, to come literally physically visit, and then say, okay, now that you know that this is a really rigorous system, it's really robust, we have good quality here, good safety, blah, 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 let's get a contract. And I know in California, one of my colleagues who performs cataract surgery was able to get some of the payers to award basically an enhanced professional fee. So not a facility fee, but you take the professional fee and for his unique modifier when it processes from his claim forms, his contract is such that he'll get paid over and above his professional fee because they're factoring in that he is doing the surgery in an office and has his own costs associated with it. Now, for me, I don't have those contracts. I haven't gotten those from payers to incorporate an enhanced professional fee on just the professional claim code. What we do is there are other ancillary billable items. So for instance, oral sedation monitoring, right? If you give an oral sedative and you have to monitor it, then there's a code for that. You know, placing a block in a typical sense, you would not bill these services because you'd be performing in an ASC where they are billing for these other things. So I get that question a lot, which is like, Omar, you can't be the only one billing these things because the rest of us are doing the same thing and we're not billing for them. Well, correct. And you also don't have the additional cost of running an OBS. There are hard costs built into that, right? And we know that the system, this is a very complex discussion, but we know that this system, the billing mechanism system that really came through CMS, right, through Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and how they started to value in the early days, how they started to value, like, how do you even figure out what a code is worth? There's a lot of data behind how to pay a code. And there is a practice expense portion to a lot of the codes where there is a practice expense, a significant practice expense. For instance, you perform a laser retinopexy in your office, in your clinic, there is a practice expense portion to that because they know that there's a hard cost to acquire a argon laser to perform a laser retinopexy. And there's electrical cost and there's the structure where it has to sit in. And there's a malpractice portion of that relative value unit assigned to that code. And then there's the professional component, which is your expertise. Those are the three components that comprise the RVU basis cost for a code. Now, when you go and you do a 67113, and you do that complex retinal detachment repair in an ASC or in a hospital, there is no practice expense component. Because you don't have that expense. The facility has that expense. So that's been subtracted from that code. So then the natural next question is, well, how do you get that thrown back into the code? Well, it's never been done before. And that's my point, that Medicare is figuring this out. It's like, what are we going to attribute the practice expense portion to? How much are we going to call it to do that? And how much do we throw back into the pot for the physicians to get that, to recoup that? Now, in the, I don't get that, right? Because until this becomes regulation, I don't get that. So the way that we recoup cost is we bill those other items that I think are not kosher to bill when you're in a different setting, but in an OBS setting, that is part of my practice expense, is doing some of these cases with the, like you mentioned, the actual pack cost, the case back table pack, the staffing. I have a per diem scrub tech, and you know, obviously the amortized cost of a construction expense, all that stuff. So that's one portion of it, is those extra billable items. The other portion of this is collecting from the patient an OBS fee, essentially, right? And the OBS fee is for performing in an office, and that's considered a non-covered. You know, our colleagues in internal medicine who run concierge models and other fields of medicine where they have cash pay models and they are still contracted in network providers, they have figured out this system really well. In fact, my daughters see a concierge pediatrician, and they have a way to carve out legally additional cash expense from their patients and still be able to bill. And that's essentially what an OBS is, right? An OBS is put under the umbrella of non-covered services for multiple reasons, you know, for dispensing a compounded eye drop, for intraoperative OCT, for whatever, all falls under non-covered services. And so they essentially, the patient's paying an OBS fee. I call it an OBS fee, and I use that term with air quotations because there's a lot of thought that goes into how that fee is structured and what falls under it, what's legal. It's part of my pioneering efforts to figure out how to make all this work. And so that OBS fee is in addition to our professional fee that we're collecting from the insurance company, in addition to those other line items that are billed, like I talked about oral sedation monitoring. Some of that stuff is proprietary to IOR partners, so I won't divulge all of it. And that comprises the total surgical fee in an OBS in my center. It more than covers running a case and the cost that it takes to run the case. And I know my hard costs, like for instance, running, you know, if I'm not putting silicone oil in, not putting perfluoro on, if I just have to break open an endo laser, you know, you're talking total case cost, maybe $600, you know, when everything is in. So I'm above that. So I'm not running a loss on these. And that's why I say that you can be profitable enough that you can subsidize community and charity care. And if you really value your services and we can get patients to pay a lot more, like our colleagues in the anterior segment surgery, then you can really change the balance of the financial pro forma for something like this.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because that sort of model does exist in anterior segment surgery. Now you do both anterior segment and posterior segment surgery. So for people who are just posterior segment surgeons, do you think that this model is sustainable, or do you really have to be kind of like how you practice with both anterior and posterior segment surgery?
No, the other retina practices that are doing office-based surgery that I know, none of them are performing concurrent anterior segment. They're only doing strictly posterior. Yeah, absolutely. You could practice this model just running a posterior. And, you know, you would just have those, like I said, those extra billable items that go on your claim form, call it an enhanced professional fee, you know, in an umbrella sense. And then also your OBS fee that you would charge the patient. And you know, it should be a sizable amount commensurate with your level of expertise, your confidence, you know, how your maybe your local socio-demographics are. And that is going to sustain this model. Then there's also this other piece that's worth mentioning, which is, what are the passive revenue opportunities from running an OBS. And one of those is increased time efficiency, right? When you have to leave and go to, let's say, operate in a hospital setting, and you've canceled your morning clinic because you just added on an RD, you've lost all the income from all those morning patients that you're going to see. Yeah, they're thrown back on the schedule somewhere else, but you only have so much time to give. So when you go to the hospital, and then your case may not be ready, and you're waiting for them to green light you and Epic so that you can move the patient from one place to another. By the time you finish, the whole experience is 3 to 4 hours until you can make it back to clinic and start seeing patients again, maybe running behind. And it's not ideal. When you're in an OBS setting, you can add that patient on and not have changed any of the patients on your surgical schedule, not have canceled anybody, not have moved anybody, because in between patients, you would just go and perform your retinal detachment repair, come right back into clinic. You're not going to lose your injection revenue. You're not going to lose your laser revenue, whatever else. For me, I've moved all of my lasers into in between surgical cases, so I don't see consults unless there's emergency or something going on that they need me for. I have an optometrist seeing patients also during that same block of time that I'm in surgery, but I'm just performing my lasers in between surgeries, so that way I don't have to have a separate laser day. I don't have to have a separate flow during my clinic to deal with this, and it has increased my efficiency. And that's worth mentioning too, that even if you were not, let's say, super profitable and you were scared to broach this OBS fee and charge a lot for it, and you're saying, I just can't see it work, just think about the inc you're basically getting back all the time that would otherwise be spent away from your own practice and away from your own clinic, and you're able to effectively add on another half a day a week or whatever it is for you and how busy you are surgically. You're adding that back into clinic.
No, that's a really great point. And I think also just from a surgeon physician wellness perspective, I mean, operating in an ASC is certainly more efficient than operating in a hospital-based setting. But if you do have to do an emergency surgery in a hospital-based setting, I mean, that could be multiple hours of time that's spent. And that takes time away from certainly your clinic if it's during clinic hours, but also time away from
Family
family and other things that one may
wears
want
you
to
down.
pursue.
Yeah, the
And
7 p.m.
so,
posted add-on case at a university hospital where I used to operate. I mean, that I'm not back home until midnight, honestly, and that's tough. And they, when do you eat dinner? Like, just see your wife for a second, go to sleep, and then you're up early again. It's draining. Now, that's a world I'm not. I have to reflect back on, because now these patients just get triaged and taken care of in the middle of office hours. And get quickly taken care of. And I feel accomplished because now I did something extra during clinic time, which is awesome.
No, that's great. One thing that I was curious about. So you obviously you offer surgery in your in OBS setting. Do you also still operate? Do you take some cases obviously to an ASC, or you take some cases to a hospital-based setting as well, or are you just strictly?
Yeah, I think you have to. Most of the data that I present at conferences is sequential vitrectomy cases and vitrectomy alone, because I think vitrectomy very safely, very easily can be performed in an office space setting. That's not true of buckles. I've done a buckle in the office, and I didn't love it. The patient actually did fine from a comfort standpoint, but I just didn't feel comfortable, and I would never perform that again. Unless I absolutely had to. I don't know what that extenuating circumstance would be. But yeah, buckles, buckle vits, they oftentimes, I think they're better serviced in an ASC. Again, there is an appropriate place for hospitals and surgery centers. It's just, I think they're being overutilized. We're just pushing way too much care through an inappropriate place of service. It'd be as if every one of your dental procedures had to go to an ASC. It's like, this is just inappropriate use of resources. You don't need to be doing that. And I think for the majority of what we do, for definitely most of vitrectomies, and I will argue that pretty strongly, for most vitrectomies, it just doesn't need to be done in an ASC. Buckles, sure. I think that's a fair point. Pain control, and it's just complexity of operation. It can take a long time, especially if you're combining with vitrectomy. So, and then of course, I serve on call. So on call services, a lot of that gets pushed into a hospital setting unless I can take them into my OBS. So yeah, I certainly still have a relationship with an ASC in a hospital.
Got it. So let's just say a patient comes in and they've got a macula-sparing retinal detachment. Let's just say it's a pseudophakic patient, superior break, and you're going to plan on doing a primary vitrectomy. Okay. Now you have options here, right? You can take this patient to your OBS. You can take this patient to an ASC. Probably not going to want to go to a hospital setting, but certainly that's on the table. Now, how do you, since the patient would be, have to pay out of pocket for OBS, how do you, what's that conversation like? Do you say like, look, I can do your surgery here, but it's going to be an out of pocket expense, or we can go to an ASC and, it'll be covered by your insurance. Like, how do you manage that?
Yeah, I get this question a lot because people feel uncomfortable with this idea of like, you can't force patients to do the things, you have to give them an option and this and that. And I agree with that too, but I also have to think about myself here and what do I want? I have to be given options, right? And I do not want to go to the ASC or hospital, and I will not be compelled to do it for a vitrectomy, period. I mean, that comes first. Is I need to be feel comfortable as a surgeon with my operating environment. And right now, I don't feel comfortable going to the hospital. I just don't think it's the right place for the patient to have their vitrectomy. And an ASC depends on the staffing. And now I don't have really control over that ASC because I'm not going there routinely. So I have the best technology in this is where I perform the best surgery is in my OBS. It's with the technology that I have, knowing I'm using the newest machinery, the newest equipment, 3D visualization, intraoperative OCT. I have everything I could ever want, silicone oil 1000, 5000, 7 mL of perfluorine, whatever I need. The surgery is going to happen in my OBS, period. If I've deemed it necessary, that's my decision. It doesn't need to be the patient's decision. Patient can decide all they want, but I'm the surgeon. I drive the ship, and the surgeons need to be empowered to think like that. You need to do what is best for yourself so you can do the best for the patient. So if that means that they can't afford to do it for whatever reason in the OBS, which that's a whole separate discussion, but you never just assume that. That's the worst thing you can do in pitching your OBS. Viability and and valuing yourself and your services is just assume that this is too expensive for most people. Well, so is life. So is your car, so is your house. Everything's expensive. So you must value yourself. But the patient is going to get taken care of with a vitrectomy in my center, bar none. And as long as they're medically stable enough for that, and majority of patients are. So if they cannot pay, then we'll give a discount. And if they still cannot, then we'll just probably take care of them. And that's oftentimes our algorithm that we go through is this is our standard fee. If you can't pay, we're gonna do some, I trust my surgical coordinators to this. We're gonna figure out some ability, some payment plan, something. And if they still really can't, then we'll give more discounts. We'll try to figure out what we can to push this through on a financial front to make sure that they can get taken care of. And if they really don't have any ability, we're still going to take care of them. But you don't lead with that because then you'll never be profitable. So that's how it works in my center. That's not a model for everybody, but it's important to hear about how my model works.
I think that a lot of doctors are, I think, uncomfortable having those types of discussions with patients, right, about the finances. Like, we would want to take care of, I think we all would just, if we had it in a perfect world, we just take care of patients and not have to worry about the finances. Of course, that's not reality, but that would be the ideal. So, are you having these discussions with the patients? Are you having staff doing that?
Excellent, excellent question. And another page from the playbook of anterior segment surgeons that I stole and learning it from the people who do this best. Never, just almost never, I won't say never, but almost never have financial discussions with your patients. It's just not appropriate. I have a colleague that I love and trust and is a really great friend of mine, and he has those financial discussions with his patients. And I just don't see the reason to do that as a physician, because now you have incorporated a bias into the discussion openly. You've admitted it by saying, even if it's in the patient's best interest that you're talking about financial stuff, you've now opened the can of worms. Your sole responsibility is to that patient and doing the right thing by them. Once you determine that, that's partly why I won't operate on a vitrectomy somewhere else if the patient's appropriate for OBS, because it is my duty to give the patient the best everything, the best of me, the best of the surgical approach, the best quality of care setting, everything. Everything needs to be the best, as if this was your own brother, sister, mother, father, whatever. That's how the patient should be treated. Oftentimes we make our decisions as physicians, especially retina doctors, are very, very guilty of this, where they'll just couch all of their decision making in financial ability. Right now, it's rampant that people are being down converted to Avastin, right? Because they're worried too much about financial viability, given that good days went down and all this other complex financial stuff. And it's like, if the patient needs Vabysmo, the patient needs Vabysmo, period. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't get Avastin, but you got to stick firm to what you believe in. And if you know, as a physician with all your training and expertise and all the knowledge that goes into this, all of it that the patient has entrusted you with, you make that decision. You say, this is the best thing for you. Listen, I don't care about finances. I don't care about this. I don't care about that. What I will say is, this is the best thing for you. The other stuff, we'll figure it out. And if we can't, at least I still did the best thing I could for you, which is to tell you this is my firm recommendation for the best way forward. And so, same thing, when I repair a retinal detachment, MAC on, listen, the best thing for you is, let's get this repaired right now. And this is the place to do it. We're going to do it right here, right now. Oh, how much is this going to cost me, doc? This and that. Listen, that's what my surgical coordinator is for. She can figure out all that stuff. But my duty to you as the surgeon is to give you the best outcome that I can possibly dream of, and to do right by you, as I would do for myself or anyone else. And that's what I would tell all my surgeon colleagues, is, if you're going to do this model, remain true to the oath you took, which is, do right by the patient. Don't inject finances into this. Figure out how you want to run your business separately, and then let someone take care of that. So there's a layer of separation.
Right. No, that makes good sense. I want to play a little bit of devil's advocate on this scenario that we talked about, which is an emergency surgical scenario, right, where you want to be able to intervene within, let's say, 24 hours. And on the one hand, you've got OBS as an option, which could happen theoretically, within an hour, right? And then you've got an ASC option that is at no cost to the patient, assuming that they have insurance that will pay for it. That maybe is at the end of the day, or maybe first thing in the morning before your clinic gets started, right? So, the patient is going to have to make a decision. They don't have days to think about it. If they can't afford it, they're not going to have time to kind of figure out, like, well, do I have friends or family or somebody who can, how can I to be able to sort of finance this? And so I think it's a little bit of an ethical dilemma, right? Where you're offering a service that's out of pocket, but then there is this other service that is, covered by insurance. Doesn't one have to have that conversation of like, look, this is what I can provide, but an option is you can have surgery at an ASC and it will be most likely covered by your insurance.
You don't, that's a really good point. And it comes back to my original statement, which is, you do not need to feel compelled. If you want to refer, that's not a bad option, right? If you say, I don't want to do this, if it's going to set you back financially. Well, but again, you shouldn't be having the financial discussions with this patient. That really, that should center around their medical care, which is, they need to have this repaired, and preferably quickly. And if you do that and you do it properly, then you won't know about all the other stuff, because you don't even need to be privy to it. Again, there's so much revenue flowing through the surgical environment that, even if it ends up being a $0 surgery on the facility side, you're still going to have done the surgery, and you shouldn't even really be thinking about that or know about that. You should just be going in to do your surgery and doing it, and looking at the books in a general sense later on, to see, like, how is my OBS functioning? And once you realize on a month-to-month basis your OBS is functioning profitably and you're doing fine, you should try to remove yourself from it as much as possible. And that's what I do. I don't even really know, honestly, about a lot of the intimate finances. I just know it's doing well, and that way, it doesn't have to cloud my judgment and how I tell a patient. And nothing, like I said before, nothing compels me that I must go. Oh, a patient says, I'm in network with XYZ. nothing compels me to go do that. Just as the same as, unfortunately, we run into the same ethical quandary with a patient brought into an ASC setting, and next thing you know, anesthesiology is billing them out of network because it turns out that that anesthesia group was not credentialed or in network with that patient's insurance plan. And they never told them. They never gave him the option to say, hey, you could bring in a different anesthesia team, or we could move you to that surgery center where they may have covered anesthesia services. It's not illegal. It's a crappy practice to do that, but it's not illegal. And that happens routinely. And I'm honest with patients that they really want to have, and I used to have these discussions before, and I hated having them, but I have to tell them honestly, listen, it's possible that we could be in a covered situation if I take you to the hospital and ASC. I cannot say the same about the facility. I can't say the same about the anesthesia. And it's not really, honestly, my job to figure that out for you. You'd have to figure that out on your own, is find out if the anesthesia services there are covered and if the facility is covered. And some patients will do the homework, some won't. But that is true, that we don't know what the environment, it's such a complex environment. We don't know what we're pushing them into. And I have had, literally have had a situation where I've taken, right before I opened up my OBS, took an epiretinal membrane back for, I think it was a 20/30 metamorphopsia. I took him back. And it was I think it was a commercial Medicare Advantage plan. And I got paid peanuts for this. And then the patient came back and showed me an EOB that came through that showed over 20,000 plus due on the balance. And I said, there's no way. I mean, I got paid almost nothing. What could that be? I'm looking through this EOB and I see anesthesia services, billing out of network and to the tune of $20,000 plus because of the vitrectomy. That scenario sucks. You never have to worry about that in an OBS setting, literally ever. So that is a big perk of running an OBS. So it is to patients' benefit and it is to the healthcare system's benefit. I don't really have that conversation that you're talking about of, well, we could go to the ASC where you're fully covered. Listen, it's going to happen here in my office. I don't need to know exactly how it's going to happen, but I do know you're going to get your retinal detachment taken care of for sure.
Right. Well, look, I feel like we could spend hours and hours talking about OBS. It's really a fascinating topic. So many nuances, and being sort of a relatively new method of delivering surgical care, I'm sure that there will be a lot more conversations about this at national meetings going forward, as there already have been. And so, look, I want to thank you for taking the time again for your candid answers, and just for sharing your experience, which I think I personally found to be really valuable, and I'm sure our listeners will as well.
Well, thank you for spotlighting this. I know it's a tough discussion to have, but the more people that get involved with this discussion from our colleagues, the better this is going to be for everybody. We need as many voices in here, both dissenting and the ones that are hoping that this really does well. We need everybody to give their input. So thank you for spotlighting this.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Omar. If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.